So, it's approximately 4:30 p.m., and today is Wednesday, April 11th, 2018. This is panel number 3404, entitled, Who's Filling My Potholes? Public-Private Partnerships. And this is one of several CWA events being held in the Boulder Canyon Theater of the Boulder Public Library, and we welcome you today. My name is Jane Brodigam. I'm the city manager for the city of Boulder, and I've been city manager for almost 10 years now. The goal of our panel today is to talk about public-private partnerships, honestly, something that we don't talk about in Boulder all that much. And so I'm really anxious to hear what our panelists have to say about the advantages that it can bring to the city and to others in our community and maybe in America. So let me introduce the panelists. We have with us Martha Clark-Goss. And Martha is on the board of directors of a number of very impressive public and private corporations. One of the things that I thought was super interesting about her background is that in years past, she worked for the Prudential Insurance Company at Prudential Power Funding. And any of you in the audience know how interested the city of Boulder is in public power. She was part of the investment arm of Prudential, responsible for its assets in electric and gas utilities and alternative energy projects. And I know that she has a lot of experience in financial management. Then we have David Spector. And David is the director of High Performance Transportation Enterprise at the Colorado Department of Transportation and is one of the people that's in charge of the great managed lanes that we have between Boulder and Denver. David's been in that position for almost 3 years, not quite, and this is a very innovative partnership work that he does for the state of Colorado. And lastly, we have Lisa Swenerton. And Lisa is the general manager and director of Southern California Edison Carrier Solutions, which involves telecommunication and wireless site development business lines in the Los Angeles area. I actually don't know what that means, and so I'm really anxious to hear what Lisa has to tell us about what she does. So the way that this panel is going to work is a little bit different than some of the ones that you might have been to up at CU. We don't have a laptop, and we're not going to be using the app for questions. So we can do either notes, and our producer in the back has notepads that you can write your questions on, or because this is such a small group, maybe we can call out our questions as well. That would be fine. Every panelist is going to start off with sort of an opening statement of around 5 minutes, and then we're going to be opening it to discussion and questions. So let me stop talking and introduce Martha.
Thank you. If I can make this work, push the on button, works. So as we were saying here, I do have a background in finance. I've been involved in a number of large project financings. I was just explaining that it's been a while back. I ran the energy project finance and electric and gas utility financing area for Prudential back in the late 80s, early 90s, which tells you how far back that is. But we did a lot of project financing. Some of you may remember that was a period of time. It was just after the Jimmy Carter administration, and they passed a law called PURPA, which was the Public Utilities Regulatory Policy Act, which was providing opportunities for both utilities and private developers to build alternative energy projects and requiring the local utilities to purchase the power at a relatively discounted rate, which worked well for 10 years during the period of time that they could sell it at the discounted rate, but then the rate went up to a normal rate, and that made several of them rather unprofitable at that point. But we did a lot of really interesting projects. I mean, we did solar mirrors in the Mojave Desert. We did geothermal plants in the Nevada Desert. We did lots of hydroelectric in the Northwest. We did lots of gas-fired cogens, including in a little town called Gilroy in California, which is the garlic capital of the world.
That's great.
And we built a gas-fired cogen, and they used the steam to cure the garlic. So awesome. There were lots of really interesting projects, and I really enjoyed that opportunity. Subsequently, I've been involved with a number of engineering consulting firms, some engineering construction firms as well, And in particular, at this point, I'm involved with a company called Berger Group Holdings. It's a small, relatively small, meaning it's $1 billion or $1.5 billion of revenues, but that's considered small in this business. It's an engineering consulting firm, and they do a lot of design work, and they do project management supervision. They do everything but construction. And they have recently been involved in some public-private partnership situations, working with various corporations. Again, they don't do the financing, but they do the design, and they work with the group of partners. So maybe I should step back. I'm assuming if you're here, you have some idea what a public-private partnership is, but maybe I should explain that. Particularly in recent years, there's been a lot of concern about how big some of these projects are, particularly if you talk about highway projects, transportation projects. One of the other boards that I'm on is a water company, and we are the largest publicly traded water company in the United States. It's called American Water. And we spend, just to give you an example, our capital expenditures every year are $1 billion to $1.5 billion for water infrastructure. So, and we're a small, relatively small company. So that gives you some sense of the infrastructure requirement, the dollar needs that are out there now for infrastructure, whether it's new or in the case particularly on west or east of the Mississippi, rebuilding existing infrastructure, improving it. I mean, I'm always so impressed when I come out here because everything's so new. I recently had an opportunity to tour the Las Vegas Water Company, and they have a million three of customers. Their plant has an average age of 19 years. Now, I will compare that to most water companies have 10,000 customers. They're all, it's a highly fragmented business. They have 10,000 customers. And the average age across the United States of water companies, the average age of their facilities is 250 years. And needless to say, they're in bad repair mostly. But again, I love it when I come out west because they're like the toll road you're talking about. It's just so exciting to see all this new stuff. But we have a desperate need for investment across the country. Many of us had hoped that the current administration would make an inroad on that. It's not clear it's going to, and it's clear that if and when they ever get to that part of their business, they will be relying substantially on private capital. So that's what the public-private partnerships are all about. It's finding an opportunity where there's a public need, whether it's for infrastructure, whether it's a toll road, whether it's a bridge, whether it's a water facility, and they need additional capital, which the government can't raise either through tax exempts because they have caps on their tax exempt, or they just don't have the credit capacity or the credit ratings to do it. Another example, again, from my water company of what we've been doing is that we've been buying out small water companies and wastewater companies, primarily in our major states like Pennsylvania and New Jersey. Because the other issue that most municipalities have with finance, again, more on the East Coast than in this part of the world, is that there's huge pension liabilities and other, again, investment in infrastructure, pension liabilities, and the municipalities need the money, so they need to sell off some of their facilities, or in some cases, they'll bring in professional management and, sort of try it out for a while and see if they like it, at which point they will consider selling the facilities. So there's a lot of opportunity for private investment and a lot of need for private investment in the infrastructure across the country, but again, particularly east of the Mississippi.
Hello. Hello? Hello. Oh, here we go. Hello.
Take a couple
minutes. Hey. Always nice to be back in Boulder. Thank you, Jane. So I do run what's called the Colorado High Performance Transportation Enterprise, and Jane and Martha are apparently some of the biggest fans of our work because normally I come into rooms like this and I don't get as much love and accolades for adding tolled express lanes onto people's roads. And I think, I'm not sure I've heard many folks from Boulder called the US 36 express lanes wonderful or marvelous. So, but we can talk about the public-private partnership that we did enter into with Plenary Roads Denver for the US 36 corridor. I first want to just react to what Martha was saying about what is a public-private partnership, because I think the definition changes depending on who you're talking to and when. I do think it is about the public sector and the private sector working together to accomplish a goal, and I think it does involve oftentimes, almost always, but not always, an investment of private capital in what is normally otherwise a public asset. But it can also be about not just the investment, but also about the life cycle cost of an asset and having something be operated by the private sector where normally it's operated by the public sector. So one story I like to tell, we're at the library, right? So Tale of Two Cities, we can talk about Boulder and Centennial, very Dickens-esque tale. Jane's group, they're filling your potholes, right? City employees, public servants who work for the city are the folks that are out there plowing the snow, filling the potholes. But if you look at the city of Centennial, you might be surprised to learn that the folks that are doing the same job in that city work for a private company. The company's name is TerraCare, and they are not public sector employees. They work for a company that has a bottom-line profit motive, and Centennial has entered into this profit, this public-private partnership. I'll call them P3 for short because I stumble over my own words a lot. And they've entered into this P3 where TerraCare does all of the public works for the city of Centennial. And so the folks who are plowing the roads and filling the potholes there are private sector employees. They don't have a pension. They're not public sector civil servants. And the topic of the panel about who's filling your potholes is interesting. I think the more interesting question is, should you care? Right? Does it matter to you? Well, if you live in Centennial, who's plowing the snow in the winter? Or in Boulder? Should it matter to you if you're driving US 36, whether or not CDOT or Plenary Roads Denver employees actually sitting in the snowplow plowing the roads? I actually think the answer is yes, and we can talk a little bit more about why, but I think that that's really the fascinating part of this, is how do you, the end user, right, the citizen, the resident, feel about it? I think there's been an expansion in the marketplace of P3s into not just transportation, and in Colorado, just so folks know, we're actually seen as a leader in using the P3 delivery method to deliver infrastructure. We've got a number of projects here, not just state and Department of Transportation projects, but the airport has a project, and Denver Union Station is a P3, and the train to the airport is a P3. But now people are talking about water infrastructure, people are talking about student housing. Does CU really want to be in the business of student housing? And so that's something that the private sector actually can do pretty efficiently, and maybe they can get together and find a model that works for everybody. So I want to note, since I'm the local guy on this panel, that the Colorado experience is fairly unique across the country. I think here in Colorado, we sort of, you know, have our little own worldview, and maybe people might say that about Boulder in particular, but Colorado is seen nationally as a leader in strategically using public-private partnerships to deliver core pieces of infrastructure. We don't use them willy-nilly. I think they are appropriate sometimes, but not all the time. But I think it's important for folks to know that Colorado is really seen as a leader nationwide in at least transportation and transit infrastructure. I'll say a few things about US 36, maybe just to poke the bee's nest a little bit, and then I always love questions about these things. But I wanted to talk to folks and just say a few things about US 36 that you might not know. What most people remember about US 36 when you talk about the P3 aspect is they remember the public meetings, the people screaming and shouting, and then we cooked up this backroom deal to sell the road to an Australian company. And if Senator Jones were here, he would tell me the same thing today. But people know that. You know that the express lanes work and that they can actually give you a reliable travel time wherever you're going. It's the only reason I got here on time today. But I want to tell you a few things you might not know. One is that we would all still be driving on the Boulder Turnpike today if it wasn't for the P3 delivery method. One of the reasons you can do a P3 is to accelerate the delivery of a project. We've all seen the transportation debate locally, not enough money for transportation infrastructure. This was one way we were able to actually deliver US 36 20 years earlier than we had it in CDOT's original plan. So that's one of the things that you might not know about US 36. Another is that it's not just about the money. Public-private partnerships can yield innovation. So CDOT designers are good, engineers are good, private sector designers and engineers are good too, and because of the model, there's that new intersection at McCaslin, which is called a diverging diamond intersection. Has anybody driven through it? Raise your hands. Yeah. Crazy, right? The first time you go through it, you're like, this is nuts. But that was an innovation that was proposed by our private partner during the bid phase. And they said, hey, you've got this traditional intersection. That's fine, but it doesn't really work well there. And by the way, if you put in this diverging diamond interchange, this crazy concept, it's one of the first, it was the first in the state and one of the first in the country, you eliminate almost every single left turn. And it provides safety benefits. Oh, and guess what? It'll save $25 million on construction costs. And that DDI, that diverging diamond interchange, in the first year of operations, saw zero serious incidents, where it was seeing about 2 incidents a month in terms of auto accidents before. So it really has proven to be both a safety benefit, it was a cost savings. And so that was a piece of innovation that the private sector brought that CDOT would not have otherwise been able to deliver. And then I'll tell you guys a secret, and you can tell your friends, but don't tell anybody else I told you this. The other thing I think that's important to know is that you get a better level of service on US 36, meaning it's less congested and it's maintained sooner, it's plowed quicker, the trash is picked up faster than any other highway in the Front Range. CDOT, our plow drivers, were whenever we're on I-25 or C-470 or I-70 towards the airport, we do not maintain and plow those roads at the same level of service, we call it in the industry, as plenary is on US 36. And that's because by contract, CDOT, HPTE, the owner, has said to plenary, thou shall make sure you're out there after a snow event this quickly, and you have to have the roads dry by this time after a snow event, and you have to repair it so frequently. So one of the things I think that folks may not know about US 36 is that you actually are getting a much better quality asset than a lot of the rest of us in the state are driving on. So I'll leave it there, but I wanted to tease some things out and maybe spark some conversation that we can talk about later on. I'll hand it over to Lisa.
So I think I have one, right?
You do, but you can use this one.
Okay.
All right.
So therefore, we can't talk at the same time.
It's better that way.
Can you hear me okay?
Yeah.
So it's very helpful to kind of get the insights of what's going on locally. I'm going to kind of broaden public-private partnerships even broader. So I think one of the things that was mentioned by David was the fact that it's defined in a lot of different ways. But I think the key thing to remember is always start with what problem are you trying to solve and who do you need to solve it. So oftentimes, a city, a state, are trying to solve problems that they don't have expertise solving. So I'm going to give you an example back in 1990s with the real estate crisis, the savings and loans that were going under. They had a tremendous amount of real estate, so a lot of loose rules on how they did real estate lending. So there was a lot of commercial properties out there, office, you name it, that were going under. And so the savings and loans were going under. So they tried to solve it. They started what's called that Resolution Trust Corporation. So they set this up. And they tried to solve it with the government, and they were pulling employees in, but that's not really their expertise. They're not having expertise in real estate. So the firm I worked for, which was Kenneth Leventhal at the time, they came in and said, they put a bid in for us to do some of that work. And they said, well, your billing rates are too high. We're not going to use you. So then they went down the path for a little longer, and then they said, you need to get in here quick. We have a problem. We have real estate we don't know how to dispose of. We're not sure what to do. So they brought in experts. So that was really a public-private partnership around the government saying, you have expertise here. Here's the problem we're trying to solve. You can't just dump all this real estate in the market because you're going to make the market, the real estate markets go down even further. So how do we set up these funds and put some of these assets in a fund and then get the experts in to grow the value of those funds instead of flooding the market? So that was really a tremendous amount of work that Kenneth Leventhal and other firms, they started realizing, go get the experts in these areas to come and help us solve these problems. So that's one example of a public-private partnership. So it's not always the capital, sometimes it's the expertise. The other is, then I moved over to Edison, which was kind of Edison Mission Group, also called Edison Capital on my side, and that's part of a company called Edison International. So we're the unregulated side of the local utility, Southern California Edison. On that side, the company invested in a tremendous amount of affordable housing. So 37 states, we invested in apartments and historic buildings, over $1 billion. And you'd say, why is an electric utility? Well, it was the unregulated side, and it was because of a tax credit. So the federal government came up with a tax credit. They said they want to subsidize this housing, find a way. So we were interested in the tax credit. But we're not owner-operators. So we look for local nonprofits, you know, that we worked with, owner-operator for-profits. We got the credit, and then we basically set up an arrangement. We were 99% owner, limited partner, exposed by our capital, so you needed that money. It came in as equity. So we've done quite a few projects actually in Denver, the Chamber Building. We talked about the tattered cover. I mean, we were involved in some different projects that were helpful in Denver, but also across the country. 70% of the portfolio Edison invested in was in California. So it could have been down near MacArthur Park, Rampart, some tough areas of Los Angeles, or next to Stanford University, where they want to get affordable housing close to where people work. So that's another example. And now I'm actually overseeing, as a general manager, which I'll tell you what I do, telecommunication. It's called a competitive local exchange carrier, so that you have a choice on where you get your connectivity. We work only with businesses and primarily large carriers. So, for example, if you might know a Zayo, they might be in the backyard. You've got Verizon, AT&T. They may want to use our cables to move their traffic. So we provide services to transport the traffic. It's digital traffic. It's kind of the lights going on and off, not analog, which is the traditional phone. And that's where everything's going, which is why you need fiber. So Southern California Edison has a very large fiber optic network that's privately owned and operated, and it's continuous. It's over 5,500 route miles, very large through all the areas, you know, the five counties, 14 million people. So, you know, even on the conversation over here, I'm chatting with David about it. Well, we need to get fiber to rural areas. And I said, well, find out where your utility is, because as a utility, we put fiber on top of all the transmission towers so that we can reach all of our customers. So as a public utility, we don't get to choose just to serve those who pay a lot of money. We serve everyone that's in our territory, no matter where they live. Could be up in Big Bear, could be up in Big Creek. So wherever our customers are, we need to serve them. So we need facilities to do that. So when we have substations in these areas, we need fiber to communicate with our substations. So there's fiber on top of those towers. So we basically is another kind of public-private partnership where we take and use excess capacity, because the most of the cost, 95% of the cost, is actually in constructing, putting an underground or overhead. About 5% or less is actually the fiber cable. So put the cable in there, and it's such amazing technology now. It's a very small cable to move a lot of traffic. So there's excess capacity. So where does the ratepayer benefit? They benefit because we have to pay back 10% of every deal gross back to the ratepayer. We also have to put a big chunk of about just under $17 million goes back to the ratepayer to use those assets. So it's a win-win. So they're getting connectivity. So what does that look like? Well, I think the biggest thing that I would say to anybody that's involved is if you're going to set up a project, typically it happens that I've got a problem to solve. So I have a problem, I need to upgrade water. I need to do these different things. How am I going to solve it? So you may have a problem. We talked about homelessness, right? Affordable housing. How do I solve it? So you come up with an idea. The next thing is you get a team of experts around you. Make sure you bring the experts in that understand this area and you get that set up. Then you start to decide, where do I get my expertise? Do I buy? And by the way, my trash in City of Orange is collected by a private company. And that works. But then I have to ask myself, okay, am I paying a little more or a little less? Is it more efficient or not? Mm-hmm. So I think the one thing that gets lost on public-private partnerships is somebody has an idea, they ran it to ground, it sounds great. The person who's most impacted, the customer who drives the roads, those who may go to a library, those who may have housing, may not have been enough of that conversation. And they come in only to maybe resist it in a meeting. But we've got to do a better job on some of these public-private partnerships to explain, here are the benefits. Like if you had told me why you did that unique design, I would have said, yeah, you're right. I don't want to make left turns. Those are dangerous, right? But it was kind of a hassle to get about. And we have roundabouts in some of our areas. Right. And now I think that's a really good example, but it annoys a lot of people. Mm-hmm. Had you found out it's safer and some of those things, if we understood the benefits that were coming. So I think that's the thing we can't lose sight of. Who are your stakeholders? Who's going to live with those decisions of the money that's incurred? Because that costs money. Those experts cost money. The capital that you bring in costs money. They're a for-profit. So what does it cost you in the end? So be thoughtful of answering those questions up front with your idea, and then really talk to your stakeholders who live with it for the next 50, 60 years. So that's my thought. Thank you.
Great. Yeah, is this still on? So thank you. Really thought-provoking. So what questions do we have from the audience? Has anybody filled out a card? No, but we do have a question.
Yeah.
So why don't you ask your question? I will try to repeat it so everybody can hear.
Okay. I tend to be kind of a practical person. I just want stuff to work.
Yes.
So I would like the panel to address what has been learned from some of the public-private sector projects that haven't been as successful. For example, I don't think we've been terribly successful dumping prisons into the private sector.
Mm-hmm.
Now, so there's got to be a learning curve here and about what works and what doesn't, and I'd like for the panel to address
that. Yeah, that's a great question.
Okay, so before you guys answer, let me... I'm not sure we want to get back up here. So the question was, what have we learned from public-private partnerships that have been less successful? For example, putting private prisons out there has maybe not been that successful. So what are the learnings from things that haven't worked?
Great question, because we learn from our failures, right? I tell my kids every day, I'm like, what did you fail at today? I'm like, great job, because that's how you learn. It's a great question. I can't speak to the prisons, but there is another good example of, and it's a sort of infamous example in the P3 world. Chicago, many years back, decided to privatize, enter into a public-private partnership for its parking meters. It hired a private entity and sold all of its parking meters and the rights to the revenues from the parking meters and the operation and the right to operate it, to maintain them, to a private entity. And the private entity wrote Chicago a big fat check up front. And then shortly thereafter, the parking rates are through the roof, astronomical, right? Lots of parking spaces unused. And Chicago hadn't built in a lot enough protections to be able to manage that through the contract. And so there was a lot of uproar about that. Another example of a failed P3 or a failure in a P3 is right in our own backyard. The RTD Eagle, University of Colorado A-Line train to the airport, right, which was designed, built, through a public-private partnership mechanism. It's operated and maintained by a private partner. I think many of us are familiar with the fact that they have some problems with the gates, right? They go down too soon before a train comes through the intersection, and it goes up too late, meaning it's safe, but people who are sitting at the intersections are taking too long. The technology does not work as required by the contract. When RTD set up that contract, it said, you have to comply with all the regs, there's a stuff called positive train control, and it's gotta go quickly. It's gotta be safe, but it's gotta go quickly. And they have not figured out how to make that work. So it's a failure, it's all over the news. RTD is getting hammered by Kyle Clark, right, every night at 6 o'clock about the gates not working. So it's failing, but here's the catch. Denver Transit Partners, the private partner who's operating that line, is writing RTD a huge check every month because they have the risk of that technology not working. When RTD set up that transaction, it said, we're going to transfer that technology risk to you, private sector. That's a risk that us, RTD, we're not as good as managing. We've never built one of these things before, a commuter rail system. And so, yes, when we watch the news, oh, the RTD A-line train to the airport isn't working, right? It's failing. The gates aren't working. But RTD and its taxpayers, us who are paying the sales tax, we're not paying for the fact that it's not working. In fact, RTD's got tens of millions of dollars coming to it since the issue started, because Denver Transit Partners has to pay them for the fact that it's not working as intended. I think the big lesson to learn from failed public-private partnerships, I think there's two. One is, don't do a public-private partnership just because you don't have the money. That's a terrible reason to do it. And entities like Chicago, who wanted a big check up front because they needed some money, the other side, the market is not stupid, and they're negotiating across from you knowing you're doing it for that reason. So I think that's a terrible reason, a sole reason, just to enter into a P3. I think that's the first lesson. And the second lesson I would say is, What do you really mean by failure on some of the toll roads that have failed nationally, P3 toll roads that have failed? It's the private entity that gets left holding the bag. Meanwhile, the taxpayers and the drivers who are driving on the road, they don't see an increase in rates, and the road is kept and maintained to operate. So even though some of those transactions can be identified as having a failure, I think the real question is who is it failing, right? And if it's the market, is that okay, right? Maybe. Maybe that's what the market should be doing, is taking that risk. So those are my two takeaways from your question.
I'm going to come at it a little different angle. I think I started with who does it impact? So he's kind of talking, the gates aren't coming up. It kind of starts back at the beginning and really framing out the agreements and working with, you know, good attorneys and folks who can really identify the right partners. So there are situations where you pulled a partner in and you gave them the risk. So it's kind of a risk return kind of thing. I'll take that risk, but give me these returns. 5 years later, they go bankrupt or out of business. So those are some of the risks that you have to be very thoughtful when you vet who that partner is. What kind of guarantees, how they're going to back them up? What's my backout solution? So I think it was very important when he said, don't just do it because you're desperate to solve it or you're desperate to get the capital, because you might be picking the wrong partner. And you might not get those guarantees that you thought you had, and they're not backing that up. So that's one thing I'll lean in. I'm going to give it from a little different lens, too. This is a little different. It was in California. And this is not a perfect example, but it's an example of somebody wanted so desperately to solve an emotional issue. And it was a gentleman, and it was written actually Malcolm Gladwell's, one of his books. I can't remember which one. But it's our three strikes, because you talked about prisons, but the three strikes in California that they put in place. And a man had lost his daughter tragically, and he was so angry, and he was so emotional. So he literally campaigned to get the government to put this in place. And years later, it's a complete failure. And it's done all the wrong things that you hoped it would have done. It's added a lot more people to our prisons and things of that nature. So sometimes people have this emotional thing, I'm just going to solve a problem, I'm going to build this housing, I'm going to do this in the community, and they get so many people caught up in that emotion that somebody didn't step back and say, who are the stakeholders, who are going to be impacted, what are some of the consequences? Have we thought this through? So I think that's a critical thing, because those that are putting the capital in will not stay in a long time if the benefits aren't there. And so we hear about bankruptcies all the time. So being thoughtful about it, I do think there's a lot of benefits. In every case that I've been involved, I see a lot of benefits. The other is, be thoughtful about the infrastructure you give away. I was just chatting about it. Infrastructure is critical for the public utility. So you've got substations, you've got the fiber optic cables. You don't want to just hand that to somebody because they can generate more revenue. We've got folks all the time that really want our towers to put antennas. That's great, but I need to run a utility. I need to be power to the home. So you have to be thoughtful about trying not to race too fast to bring others in that are going to generate revenue and start to impair those assets because you thought you could solve it differently. So again, it's stopping and thinking about it and really making sure you've thought through some of those questions and some of those risks. And that really is for the upfront team, and to get information to those that are impacted so they can have a view on that as well. So those are my thoughts.
I just add a couple quick comments to some of your points. I think the issue that you're talking about in performance is addressed if you work on what they call service level standards. Mm-hmm. Service level standards. When you negotiate a contract for anything, really, you know, when I'm negotiating a contract with an outside vendor for something, typically you put in something called service level standards. And everybody agrees up front what the expectations are and what the performance is and what the penalty is for lack of performance. And that needs to be thought through quite, you know, thoroughly, because for all the reasons that are described here, if you think through it beforehand, it's a form of risk management. And so I would say that's one issue, service level standards. What are the expectations and what are the penalties if you don't meet the expectations? The other thing that I've seen is, for instance, on our water company, when we buy facilities from a local utility, we generally, the way we've structured our deals is that we have made a guarantee that we will not raise the prices, because price is the other issue that comes into play here. We've made a guarantee that we, in most of our deals, that we will not raise prices greater than inflation. Now, I mean, there are a lot of examples in the water industry where people have come in and bought the water company and nobody paid any attention to that, and all of a sudden the rates went up 50%. And we know from experience that that's not good for anybody. You know, our customers aren't going to be happy, and we'll be miserable running that plant and everything else. So we have worked the economics, and in fact, there's been a big issue in water infrastructure again because it's such a fragmented business, and there's so many of them that are now going on the market for sale. And there are a lot of players. You mentioned an Australian company, for instance. There are a lot of players who are private equity players that are in the business of trying to buy up these facilities. And a lot of times it's less today because people have had some bad experiences. But the municipals are a little naive sometimes, and they don't anticipate that the rates might go up or might go up a lot. And so we feel, as a public utility, because we are also governed by the state commissions, that we have to be honest about what the costs are going to be, but we have to work it through the financing so that we can provide the opportunity that people can get investment in their infrastructure. Part of what our commitment is when we buy these facilities is to spend money to upgrade the facilities, get them up to snuff, and do it in the context of not raising the rates more than inflation.
Do we have some more
questions? Yeah, from the back.
Is somebody back here?
Yeah, great. So you can talk loud, right?
I think I can be loud enough, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. And far enough back. My question is a specific sort of variation on the first question that's for David, that I'm a big fan of the U.S. grid project, like James said. I think, it's been a great, it's greatly increased our transportation.
Yeah. I love that question because the question itself and the answer to the question, it's circular. It's going to be fantastic. So it'll take a little bit of setup, but let me get there.
Okay.
So US 36, it works really well, right? But we screwed that up, right? When I say we screwed it up, I wasn't there, but we as a state, I was in the governor's office at the time, but we did not message that well. We did not take extra steps to educate our stakeholders about what it all meant. We went through what was the typical, and actually still is the typical, environmental approval process. NEPA is the National Environmental Policy Act. And we went through those steps. We had the public meetings, and that's all we did. And then when we closed, we signed the contract with the private entity, but before we closed on the financing, all hell broke loose, right? And there was a bill passed in the state legislature, thanks in part to a lot of the electeds in this area. Governor Hickenlooper vetoed that bill, but in that veto, he also issued an executive order which required additional transparency measures, us, HPTE, the High Performance Transportation Enterprise, to take additional transparency measures so that we did not screw that up again. And so I love that you asked that question about, is there another project? We just closed a $1.2 billion public-private partnership for a highway infrastructure project here in Colorado in December. And although we've had a lot of public comment and outreach and actual dissatisfaction with the project itself, almost none of it has been about the P3, the public-private partnership delivery method. So the fact that you're even asking that question warms my heart because it means we actually learned our lesson here. Sorry that you all were the guinea pigs, but we have learned our lesson. So what we did this time around that was differently for I-70, and I'm talking about I-70 in between like Brighton Boulevard and Tower Road, we're going to take down the viaduct near the Purina plant. We're going to bury it and put a 4-acre cover on it. We're going to reconnect the neighborhoods of Globeville and Elyria and Swansea just east of the Stock Show complex. And we're going to add express lanes in each direction in that piece. And the opposition to that project, and there's always, I think, opposition to any public works project, but the opposition to that project doesn't come from the fact that it was a P3, and that's because we had 4 specific meetings in addition, above and beyond the additional public outreach we did, just on the P3 delivery method itself. We also did what's called a telephone town hall, where we picked up the phone and we called everybody in the zip code and let 4,000 people participate in a public meeting that way, instead of forcing you to come to a meeting in a school auditorium that only holds 200, that's during your dinner time with your kids. So we took a lot of lessons from it. We were knocking door to door, educating folks. We did a lot better job of educating our state elected officials, which was one of our big problems last time. And so I was meeting regularly, right, with Majority Leader Winter, with Dickie Lee Hollinghorst, with Matt Jones, to make sure they were educated. The last thing I'll say that we did is we went over and above on the transparency. One of the criticisms of US 36 when we did the deal was backroom deal, cooked up in the back room. Smoke-filled back room is what I think it was called. So we named our conference room. We put a little placard on it, said smoke-filled back room. But thank you. Yeah, I thought it was funny. Senator Jones, not so much. When you go through these processes with the public sector who's bidding and competing for, or the private sector who's bidding and competing for your work, you are issuing them a draft of the contract you want them to sign. And this procurement took a long time. Every time we issued that draft to our four bidding teams and said, hey, here's the new terms after we've had some negotiations and here's the revisions, we sent that to every single state elected official, every single local elected official, and said, here's the contract. We are not hiding anything. We have nothing to hide. Here are the terms that everybody else is bidding on. You get it the same day the private sector gets it. I will tell you, the private sector didn't love that, but it actually really was a great risk mitigation strategy, because it took away the ability of anybody to say, you know what, HPTE, State of Colorado, you were hiding the ball. You were not transparent. So we did learn some lessons. We did screw things up here, but hopefully it's working well enough that we're making a little bit of that up. And the fact that you're even asking, is there another public-private partnership that we've done, is great, because it means that we actually did our job, at least on that piece, on the Central 70 project. Yes, that's correct. RTD will tell you that they don't have the funds right now to finish the line that you all voted on and approved. And I know that it's a big issue. It's a hot issue in Boulder County. So there is a plan, but it's a very long term. It's like 2040, right, Jane? Something like that.
Yeah, so here's the thing. I'm the moderator, and I'm not supposed to answer questions, but I am actually going to answer them.
Good.
You're probably the most knowledgeable.
Better you than me.
When the voters voted on the increase in taxes to provide light rail to the Denver area, the vote did not include light rail to Boulder County. It included commuter rail. Commuter rail is different than light rail. I'm right, aren't I, David?
Yeah, absolutely. It's a heavier rail. It's on heavy tracks and heavy rail, and it can go, in Boulder's case, it goes along the freight corridor on the same freight tracks, actually, here.
And because it's on the freight tracks, or it would be on the freight tracks, what is sold on freight lines is time of use. And the value of time of use to put a commuter train on that does not pencil out when you could put commercial products like fracked oil and gas, which is what they're putting on the freight tracks. And so the cost for RTD and for CDOT, to do that is so expensive that the estimated time of arrival of the train is 2042. But I hear often that people in Boulder County believed that we were going to get light rail. We were never going to get light rail. It was going to be heavy freight rail on a commuter rail. So I just wanted to debunk that for a minute.
Excuse me.
Well, right. That's until 2042. So that is why The local governments in this area are focusing on bus rapid transit along the major lines. And in particular, in Boulder's case, we're hopeful to get bus rapid transit up to Longmont in the semi-near future. And I'm not going to answer any more questions. It's totally contrary to the rules.
Well, I really appreciate her breaking the rules.
Yeah.
I do too.
I'm just going to add that this is such a great discussion here about the complexity of it, about you believed you voted for something and you were going to get something you didn't. And this is where those that are on the side that have these ideas and these projects and are doing it, we have to be better. And you gave some examples of really making sure the stakeholders, those that are going to be actually using what we're doing or benefiting from the housing or the road, there's more communication and clarity. Because, I mean, even though it's great, you'll give the contracts to everybody. I don't know about you, but I have a lot of other work on my desk. And so you gave me the data, but if I don't get it in a way that I can really abstract what that means to me as a stakeholder, that's a challenge. And so I think we've got to be thoughtful how we're communicating to our constituents to build that trust and to build kind of where we're going. It's transparency, but it's also giving it in a way that you can understand the impacts. I think that's the key we've got to get better at. She had a question.
I have a question in a very different direction, and I just like to a concern really that I'd like to have addressed that was sparked actually when David was speaking about the plowing thing in Centennial versus Boulder. And living in rural Colorado, I understand the importance of infrastructure in itself for itself. I want to be able to drive home after my road floods out and it gets fixed. And I think about infrastructure in this country as a twofold thing. Our infrastructure was actually first built, was it not, as a public works job creation vehicle.
Yeah.
Are we not selling out our good pension jobs? Mm-hmm. How is this a conscionable thing to view a snowplow driver without a pension as a positive? Mm-hmm. Can we as a society not prioritize, in a world where I'm a nurse, I'm not going to run out of the job longer than any of you, but we're talking about technology taking over every job. Why are we selling out our infrastructure and our good jobs and our pensions for a quick buck?
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I'd like to just start with that because I think those are such good and important questions. My company owned a lot of coal plants, and those coal operators lost their jobs. People could say it's not good for the environment, but it's how they made their living. Pensions are a big issue for a lot of companies. When you talk about public sector, it becomes the rate payers and the taxpayers that are paying those costs. So it's a real balance. People have to be willing to pay more to kind of allow for some of those benefits. And that's really, it's been hitting at all levels. So those are my observations. I can let them share, but I've seen that as well. I know with our ratepayers, we're making as many cuts as we can, which includes jobs, because our electric customers need us to lower the rates. 30% of our electric customers are lower income. So there's so many different ways to look at it. It's tough, but those are some of the challenging decisions that have to be made. So I'll just share from our perspective, we're very focused on reducing rates. And that includes sometimes people's jobs, benefits, and things of that nature.
Well, and I would take it a step further as a public utility, and I assume, Lisa, you have some of the same challenge. Public utilities traditionally have been very generous in their benefits. Mm-hmm. I assume you've gone through a lot of restructuring of your benefits as well over the last 10 years for that reason. And so it isn't necessarily true that if somebody is coming in as a private sector provider that they're not providing pensions, but they probably are not providing defined benefit pensions. Mm-hmm. And that is an even bigger public policy issue. They probably are providing 401ks and maybe matching contributions. But I used to run many years ago, I ran the pension subsidiary for Prudential. This was back in the early 90s. And I had a fellow who was working for me at the time. And at that time, it was fairly prevalent that people had defined benefit pensions that they were retiring on. And it was about 10 years after they had first originated 401ks. 401ks were introduced in the early 80s. And this man told me at the time, he said, 20, 30 years from now, nobody's going to have a defined benefit pension. And that's unfortunately the case. There are very few people. I'm lucky enough to have one from Prudential. But most people today are not getting defined benefit pensions because there's a whole, you know, issue in terms of the guarantees, the amount of the returns that people can expect, and the fact that it's a guaranteed pension of X for X number of years, however long you live. I mean, that's not what you asked the question about, but it's a practical reality. And even the utilities, which have traditionally been very generous in their benefits, have had to eliminate defined benefit pensions and have had to take steps to provide, shall we say, more sharing of costs with health benefits, et cetera. So it doesn't excuse it. It's a practical reality that's not just in the public works sector, not just in the private sector, and definitely not in the tech sector. I would bet there are virtually no tech companies that provide defined benefit pensions.
Great question, and I want to take it on directly, right? Because it wasn't just folks like you who were saying, hey, how is this conscionable for you to take these jobs away from the public servants who should be doing this? In fact, CDOT has 3,000, over 3,000 employees, and the guys who run the plows, and I say that because it's almost like 99% men, they were petrified and angry. They were mad. But here's what has happened in actuality. As you may know, we haven't raised the gas tax since 1991 in Colorado, so we haven't funded transportation with any new dollars, and so we have been trying to do more with less. That means our maintenance crews are paving, are plowing more miles, right? And when we build them with the same crew, the same equipment, the same, and no more people. We're not allowed to actually hire more people in the state. We've had a hiring freeze for a long time. So these guys are stretched really, really thin. The first year after US 36 was on board, they were actually thrilled because it gave them the ability to do their job out in Longmont and State Highway 119 and up by 25 North a little bit better. They were able to focus on it. They don't have now an extra 40 miles of lanes that they have to plow on US 36. So by taking that off the system, we have actually allowed our guys to do a little bit better job because they've been stretched so thin and focus more on some of the other pieces. We haven't fired anybody. And here's the crazy thing, which has happened. It's now a retirement option for folks. So PARA's getting gutted, right? I'm a public servant. The Public Employee Retirement Association, Colorado will probably get downgraded here soon because our PARA, our pension system, is in such trouble. Folks at CDOT, most of these guys who have been driving plows for 20, 30 years, they can retire, take their benefits, and they can go work for Plenary Roads Denver to plow US 36 after their retirement and still make money and still get their pension. So we've been seeing some really interesting ways that this works itself out. I'm not saying that it doesn't have an impact, and we've had to work really hard with our team to let them know that this isn't taking jobs away from them. But if we're adding lane miles to the system, you're adding infrastructure, and you need to either add people or equipment to take care of it. And since we don't have the money to do it, and we're not allowed to hire people, AP3 can be one way to address that issue.
But it's taking jobs away from the economy moving forward. It's not taking those existing jobs, but instead of creating more good, respectable jobs, we're creating. And I was
just
saying, as you move forward, the thing I ask you as a constituent to value the life of the lowest worker in any infrastructure, and I want to pay more.
Absolutely.
That is the smart thing to do, and maybe we're not voting for the smart thing in this state because we have Tabor and no one votes for taxes.
That's right.
But at some point, we're going to suffer if we don't put our tax dollars towards making sure that the base minimum job, that the guy out there working his tail off, my brother-in-law's a postman, he is a respectable individual, he has pride in his job. The Postal Service is now hiring people who are not government employees because they're not. Yeah.
I would love to have a Tabor conversation. Turns out Plenary has hired 40 folks in their office and about another 40 folks on this corridor. So it has actually been a net job creator here for higher wages than now. They don't get PARA, but maybe that's good. No, it's good.
Question, Steve.
Remember, we're asking questions, not comments.
Thank you.
So, yes.
Types of projects does the P3 lend itself more favorably to, and conversely, which kinds of projects is P3 maybe not as good an answer.
I would ask you
probably know that best.
So in the United States, Canada, infrastructure in Ontario, every public project has to be delivered through using a P3. And if you're not going to use a P3 method, then you have to justify why not. So in other places, including just north of the border, it's used for everything. Hospitals, courthouses, schools, they use it a lot up there. Here we've got the ability to use public financing, municipal debt, so we don't use it as much. In the United States, it has not caught on as much as it has in Europe or in Latin America. Here it's been mostly transportation, but you have seen some social infrastructure, we call it, Long Beach Courthouse, Long Beach Civic Center. There are some new student housing. Generally, a revenue stream helps. So if there is a revenue stream that's generated, that can help. But those are the kinds of infrastructure projects that have been most prevalent, I would say, in the United States. Martha, are there water projects that you know of that have been delivered?
I don't think so. I think they're either municipal or they're private. Mm-hmm. But in my experience, too, most of them have been things like highways and airports.
Yep.
Those airports are the big projects. LaGuardia Airport right now is being redeveloped as a P3.
Yep.
So I'll just add on a public-private partnership. I think the Section 42 Affordable Housing Program has been very successful to bring out quality housing where you know the investor, making sure it's safe and decent. So I think the key is that there's lack of transparency. So when Edison invests, we don't want to hear bad things are happening in an apartment, you know, in New Jersey or something. So we are really on top of that. There's a lot of oversight because we don't want our reputation to be damaged. So that's a really good partnership because you see who those big investors are and who's getting the benefits out of it. So I think that's a key thing. I think that we're starting to see some things in California across the country in fiber. So they're trying to get fiber to the home. They're trying to get fiber in underserved areas. So the state of California, through the California Public Utilities Commission, is putting out grants, and you have local folks that are building out the networks, and then they work with folks like us that might haul that traffic back across the territory and connect it more to the World Wide Web. But those are some we are seeing and kind of touching on. I think the danger sometimes is the federal government comes out with ideas, and then they throw a bunch of money at it and grants, and what you have is kind of startups and companies that don't really have experience get awarded these dollars, and we've seen that with some broadband programs that have not been successful. So you've got to make sure, again, don't bring people in because they say, oh, I'll do it and I'll take the funds and get the fees, because 3 years later, your project's been mothballed, costs are gone, it's bankrupt, and that's a risk. So again, you have to be thoughtful when you're at the upfront how you're building your teams.
Back to something you said, Lisa. You said your company was attracted to affordable housing, a national issue, because of the tax incentives.
Yes.
How have those incentive structures changed, or have they, with the new tax bill? Is that going to change your company's interest?
So my company invested in affordable housing for quite a few years. And let me see, from 1989 to 2001, something interesting happened in California called an energy crisis. Mm-hmm. So given that, we had a lot of losses. We didn't have a lot of revenues. So we slowed down the investment in affordable housing. We were out of it for about 3 years. We actually came back to look at investing in it, but the returns had gone down, which is a good thing. A lot of capital was going in. So there was a lot of money going into affordable housing. Literally just had a conversation with someone, and it was on a panel I was on. Since the tax credit reform went through, we're already hearing that almost $28,000 per unit less in dollars available because the tax credit, what people are going to pay for the tax credit, is going down. Because remember, when corporations don't have a steady tax bill, they don't need a consistent tax credit. So the unique thing about this tax credit is you take the tax credit over 10 years. So I might get a $10 million tax credit. I take $1 million a year over 10 years, and I have to make sure it's affordable for their full 15-year period or 30. Well, I have to have predictable revenue. So when you just change the tax rules, and so I pay less as a corporation, I don't have that need to write down any taxes. So there is a direct impact that they are already seeing today, and the number was $28,000 per unit. In California, we have other issues. We had money with redevelopment agencies. That's gone away. So there's some serious gaps, and I'm concerned because I think that's a very good program. Again, It comes back to taxpayers understanding those things and saying, I want more money in my pocket, but understanding the consequences of getting more money in your pocket. Yeah. So we have to be more informed because people say this is great, and then pretty soon you're going to see more folks without housing. I can start because there's a lot of good examples with housing. So it's a federal program, but it's allocated the credits, just like in Colorado, at the state level. So if you left it just to the investor, I don't think that's a good idea either. So anybody that's invested in that project. So actually the state of California does audits on the buildings and the records. So the state's always looking at safe and decent. Did you rent to people that were not qualified? Where are your, where's your documentation? A lot of oversight. We also, as an investor, would do oversight to make sure, again, they're doing the right thing. But the cities often, and maybe other municipalities invest, they come in and look. So it's a very closely kind of oversight that I have really think was working really well. It's cumbersome, but you better do the right thing, right? So I think they catch things. There's cure periods. But if there's real egregious, I have not seen that in the portfolio. We had 28,000 units. I didn't see anything egregious. When we see something, we address it right away. Doesn't mean somebody's not trying to do the wrong thing. You catch it and fix it. That's a pretty well-established program, though. I think what would be more interesting is kind of some of the projects that you're doing now. So that's been around since 1989.
So I think the short answer is one of the best things you can do to have oversight is to have experts internally, right, at the city or the state who are interfacing with that private partner to have that oversight. I've got a team, I've got an engineer, I've got a tolling person, right, and they are working. I talk to the plenary guys every day. We've got folks out on the road checking to make sure they're doing the right thing. So it's a self-reporting regime, right? They're telling us what they're doing, but we're out there actively monitoring it. But that's because there is this thing that the legislature saw fit to create in 2009 called the High Performance Transportation Enterprise. We were set up to provide oversight of these kinds of projects. I think where folks can get in trouble is if you enter into these public-private partnerships without that center of expertise internally, because now you're kind of winging it, right? And you're asking your public sector employee who's really never done this before and who has an expertise in something else to go ahead and manage this portfolio of schools or whatever it is, and you can just get steamrolled, right? So to me, that's the biggest key is to create either a center of expertise or a person whose duty it is to make sure they are engaging with that private sector partner all the time.
Or a third-party engineer, third-party provider, who is independent of the PPP, the private partnership person.
So we're about 5 minutes away from the end. Does anybody have another question? Yes, sir.
President Trump ran, part of his campaign was to have $1 trillion spending on infrastructure. Obviously, we haven't been able to get that through. Is P3 a good answer to help get part of that rolling, or is that kind of immaterial at this point?
Great question.
It is, and I think it's part. I have mixed feelings about that because he's talking about his $1 trillion, and he's now talking about some portion of it and a substantial portion of it coming from private partnerships. And I don't think that's what he ran on. I don't want to get too political about it, but that's not what he ran on. But it's a good solution. It just isn't what we were all counting on. I have a particular bone in that fight because I live in New Jersey. And there, as I'm sure some of you have heard, if you haven't all heard, there's a huge problem with the tunnels from New Jersey into Penn Station in New York. Last summer, we were shut down. We had several tracks, I want to say 6 or 8 tracks out of like 20, that were shut down for a month and a half. It was supposed, the new tunnels were supposed to have been built in the 2008, 9, 10 timeframe. Chris Christie pulled the plug on that and took the funds to dedicate to New Jersey highways. And that's fine. I mean, I benefit from that too, although I would not say our highways are great. But they had finally worked out a year ago that because it's Port Authority of New York and New Jersey, and so both New York and New Jersey have to agree on whatever the plan is and have to agree to contribute money to it. They had, you know, worked out their deal. They had gotten a certain amount of funding from the federal government. Everybody was sort of relieved because it's going to take 5 or 10 years to build this anyway. And Trump just pulled the plug on that one. So it's, you know, as I say, I don't want to get too political about it, but I think it made a great campaign promise, but I have no confidence that he's going to deliver.
Okay. I would just say, right now the plan is $200 billion of real federal dollars to leverage, right, up to $1 trillion of infrastructure packages, and that difference is going to come from things like public-private partnerships. It's also intended to come from local share, right? So state of Colorado, cities, locals, like this is a self-help infrastructure plan. I will say that P3s, and I'll say this till I'm blue in the face, they are a tool, right? But I've got quite a toolbox, and I've got lots of tools in my toolbox, and it's a good tool to have, but it's not the only tool. And I think that one of the best tools you can have is real dollars that you can contribute towards infrastructure. And this plan has, I would say, a lot of, if you asked a lot of people in the biz, they would say there's probably not enough real dollars in the biz, or in the plan for infrastructure.
One more question. Yes, sir.
I'd love to hear more of those other tools beyond P3s that you have in your toolbox. Mm-hmm.
Public financing is one. We use municipal bonds, general obligation, or revenue-backed bonds to do it. Pay as you go, right? And the other tool that there are some other tools like self-help, right? So we're going to probably see here in Colorado a ballot initiative on the ballot in November to raise your sales tax or some other tax by a certain percentage to go towards transportation infrastructure. Well, it's Tabor, right? We must vote on any tax increase in Colorado. So if you think that's where we want to invest, those new revenue streams can help. There are other kinds of more obscure tools, different things you can do, but those are the main ones that we generally use as municipal finance. I actually access right now the private capital market, so HBTE can go out and get a bank loan or a construction loan. So we'll do that where it makes sense. So there's different ways to do it, but financing, borrowing is not funding, and you can only borrow so much until you're tapped out. So real money actually helps.
So I'll just speak just in generalities to another thing. If you're trying to solve a problem, somebody's trying to solve the same one. So what we're seeing in some areas, if you want to, you know, they kind of call it a dig once policy they're trying to do in California. If you're going to dig up the street, then let a lot of the players that want to put fiber and other things, you kind of do that at the same time. So there's different ways that are trying to say, how do we get this done? Because you don't have to dig the streets twice for three providers to put fiber in the street, so you have a choice. Another is coming in, again, with other partners that have a vested interest where you can share the cost. So there are a little bit of things that I've seen along the way, and along with public finance. We have a lot of initiatives in California, and sometimes that's a concern to me. I don't people really understand all the things they're voting for. So kind of you can get yourself pretty saturated with so many projects, with so many things to solve. So that's a concern to me as well, as being thoughtful and looking at those initiatives. But there's so many. There's so many.
Thank you so much. We've had great questions from the audience.